From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The arrest of an Australian white supremacist in the recent mass shooting of 50 people at two mosques in New Zealand came as a shock to many in Australia. With elections scheduled for later this year, the conversation about immigration in the country had already been red hot. Now, one of the most potent issues in that debate is Australia's continued detention of about 1,000 refugees and asylum seekers on the remote Pacific islands of Manus and Nauru. Conditions for those on these islands are reportedly poor, and at least a dozen people have died in Australian detention over the past 5 years. Now, rights groups say that Australia has created island prisons for refugees and that the policy is both inhumane and illegal under international law. Australia's government argues that it needs to keep the detention centers open as a way to deter a flood of refugees and would-be asylum seekers from coming to Australia by boat. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at Australia's policy of warehousing asylum seekers on two tiny Pacific islands. To start, we're joined by Abdulaziz Mohammed. He's a refugee from Sudan's Darfur region who has been a detainee on the island of Manus in Papua New Guinea for the past 6 years. He joins us today, however, from Geneva, Switzerland, where he was recently allowed to travel and speak before the UN Human Rights Council. Abdulaziz, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us, what is daily life like for you and the other men that are kept on Manus in Papua New Guinea?
Well, thank you for having me once again. The simplest way for me to describe the daily life on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea is we don't have a life. We don't have a life at all. We have only a one routine which keep repeated for almost 2,000 plus days on that detention prison. And we also have been exposed to such a horrible and inhumane conditions where our dignity, our identity, and everything.
Well, what are those conditions like? Like, where do you live? How do you eat? How are you cared for?
In fact, we are living in a hell. That's the only way I can put it. We are living in a hell, and a hell that even far away from the rest of the world, where you don't get a proper treatments, you don't get a proper foods, you don't get a proper place to sleep. So we are just, as the Australian government described us, a trash bag inside a garbage bin.
Well, let me back you up there, because you talked about poor conditions for you and the hundreds of other men who are kept on Manus, where you've been for 6 years. Seven of the people you've been detained with there have died. Talk to us about how these men, what happened to them?
In fact, the reason why those people have died, it's because of the Australians' deliberate policy, where it's been designed to dehumanize a human beings and use them in their own political agenda. Let me start with the first victims. It was on 2013, February of 2013. He was only 24 years old. He's an Iranian nationality. We protest because we were demanding the authority to provide us a process, as the Australian government saying that it's a processing center while there's no process. We demand for process, we get someone killed, and he's beaten to death in front of us. And they set him as an example.
And so you're referring to this protest in 2014, this man, an Iranian Kurd, I think, Reza Barati. He was killed by security personnel during a protest, you said.
Yes, exactly. That was the first victim on the islands. And after that, 2015, we had another victim. He has only a mosquito bite, and he has lost his life. And after that, the numbers that the list is.
So I'm sorry, you said he died from a mosquito bite. So it sounds like he didn't get proper medical treatment then for a related infection.
Well, he died because of mosquito bite. We don't have a medical treatment on the islands. It was a negligence from the authority. And the other two victims as well, three of them in total victims, they have died because of the medical negligence on the ground.
So in other words, they died from diseases or ailments that were otherwise preventable then. And I understand that there's also a big issue among these several hundred men who have been detained here for years is depression and suicide. Talk to us about that.
The depression and suicide, it has reached the highest level, I can say. And as we speak at the moment, I have lost 3 men that whom I know personally, and I've been engaging with those people. And the reason why even they took their own life is because they felt powerless, and they are mentally, they have been damaged, and physically they have been damaged. So they had enough of the painful life on that hellhole of the islands. And 3 of them, they decided to take their life, but it did not happen in a way that where the authority, it's happened on the presence of the authority, where even the authority are aware of the cases. The authority know what is happening with those people. But in fact, they did not prevent the death. They watch until those people take their own life by themselves.
Well, and I understand I understand what you're relating about the mental health issues there among the detainees on this small Pacific island are quite serious. Doctors Without Borders released a report on Nauru back in December. It said that more than 30% of the patients that had treated there had attempted suicide. Something like 60% had suicidal thoughts. What is the state of detainees now? Is it improved?
Let me put it this way. As someone who's been on the island for the last 6 years, I never step out of the islands. And part of me and my friends, we are helping the other men who are suffering from a severe mental health illness. Every day, I used to witness from 3 to 4 people who are self-harm, suicide attempts, overdose. This is it becomes like one of the daily routine for me that I used to witness. And people have lost hope in the authority. The current situation on Manus Island is we have an humanitarian crisis. And at the same time, we have a medical crisis where hundreds of the men who suffer mentally, physically, and they don't get a treatment. We become like a soccer ball that now the authority are passing us to each other or kicking us to each other. They are trying to force us to access to a local health system on the island, where that health system is not even adequate for the own people on the islands.
Yeah, and now, I understand Manus, it only has about 10,000 people, but we talk about detention centers here, but I understand that you and the hundreds of other refugees and asylum seekers kept on Manus, you can move outside of the compounds and the detention centers. It's not like you are jailed behind walls there, is that correct?
In fact, one of the reality that people here don't know it or they miss it is that we have only forcibly, they have removed us from the former detention center. That was on the end of 2017. They accommodated us in a new facility where still there is a curfew which is imposed on us and enforced by the police on the island from 6 to 6. And at the same time, the island is such a small place where we are not welcome on that island because of the introduction that Australia gave to the people of the islands, that we, Australia, introduced us to the islanders, that the Manus Island people, that we are criminals, terrorists, and people who have dumped our identity. And nowadays, that introduction, it's been switched off to another introduction that people are pedophiles, murderers, and rapers. This is how they call us. And the people on the islands, they hate us. They don't want us to be in their community. They want us to get out of that place. But in fact, the government is still do not want us to get out of that state. That place. And as I can say, we are thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but every element of our life, it's been indicated by the Australia.
Well, Abdulaziz Mohammed,
worstest moment in our life.
It sounds like a very grim situation there, but I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
A reminder that this is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about Australia's policy of indefinitely detaining asylum seekers who arrive by boat on 2 remote Pacific islands. We just heard from the Sudanese refugee Abdulaziz Mohammed, who's been detained on Manus in Papua New Guinea for the past 6 years. Up next, we're going to bring in Eli Shakiba. She's an Iranian journalist who felt she had to flee her home country due to government repression. She tried to come to Australia, but wound up in detention for 6 years, including 5 years on Nauru, which is something like 2,000 miles from the Australian coast. She was resettled recently in the United States, and she joins us now from Los Angeles. Ellie, welcome.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me today for the great opportunity to speak out on behalf of refugee communities in Nauru.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to have you. I was hoping you could just tell us briefly about your journey from Iran to Australia and then eventually to Nauru.
Oh, if I want to tell you my journey to Australia and then being transferred to Nauru in a simple way, when I left my country, I thought it might be, if I stay alive, it might be like a time machine that can take me from medieval time to 21st century to have freedom of speech. To have freedom, any kind of freedom, and but what happened exactly was a kind of the time machine was broken, and it took me to prehistoric time instead of 21st century, and it took me to a place that were nothing, no facilities or opportunities to live.
So I'm sorry. So I was actually asking about how you physically got to Nauru, and it sounds like, if I understand your story correctly, you went to Indonesia first and then came to Australia by boat, where you were detained.
Yes, yes. I went to Indonesia and tried to reach to Australia by boat, and I arrived on Christmas Island in August 2013, and I was transferred to Nauru in January 2014.
So it sounds like you followed sort of a common route for people looking to get to Australia. Then Christmas Island is only it's a small island that belongs to Australia, but it's actually only a couple hundred miles off the Indonesian coast. So you went there and you were detained, and then you wound up in Nauru. Talk to us about conditions for people in Nauru.
Conditions for people in Nauru was terrible. People were detained in nylon tents at the hot island with no aircon. And these people included women, innocent people, like women, children, families. And they were not allowed to speak out. And nobody could hear about what's going on in Nauru. And no journalists were allowed to come to Nauru and to provide a report about what's happening there. And Australian government and Nauru government tried to just keep them quiet, detained on Nauru. So, and it was what drove people to die.
Yeah, so I mean, it sounds like you were kept there mostly with families, women, and children on Nauru. You were involved in this campaign that got a lot of attention last year called Kids of Nauru, that really highlighted the plight of children there, because as we heard Abdulaziz talking about, there's a huge problem with depression among the refugees, among the asylum seekers there, high rates of self-mutilation. And among children, there was this rare disorder observed called resignation syndrome, where it sounds like the children become, they sort of withdraw from social activity and become almost like catatonic and stop eating and drinking. Talk to us about that situation.
That was actually a horrific situation. What happened exactly was people were so disappointed and sick, especially children and teenagers. And the situation was like this while Peter Dutton was telling media and Australian people that there is no more kids in offshore processing centers. And last May, May 26th of 2018, we just tried to reunion all the children at the same place and take a photo of around 148 children who still were detained on Nauru. And I sent the photo to my friend who's a former teacher in Nauru, and she's in Australia, and she participated at the TV show called Q&A. And she asked there at the TV show that as a questionnaire guest, asked Peter Dutton, if there is not any child in Nauru, and who are these children in Nauru, detained in Nauru now? And then after that, it could take attention from media. I think that was the beginning.
I mean, this got a lot of publicity, and ultimately, it sounds like most all of the children were eventually moved from Nauru. Is that correct?
Yeah. The campaign was successful, and finally, it could get off all those children from Nauru, and they were really sick, too sick. Well, there were lots of trying to suicide and not to eat, and even self-harm by those children and teenagers.
Well, Ellie, I mean, what you describe is absolutely, I mean, it sounds absolutely horrible. I mean, talk to us, if you would, about, and our time does grow short, but I understand that you have recently been resettled in the United States just a couple weeks ago under this deal that was brokered between the United States and Australia back under President Obama, where about 1,000 refugees could be resettled from Nauru to the United States, and Australia in return would take some refugees or asylum seekers who had been seeking to get to the U.S. What has it been like for you to spend 5-6 years on Nauru and then all of a sudden be sent to Los Angeles?
To me, it's like a miracle, but I cannot be actually 100% happy and excited as I have to be, because there are still people detained on Nauru and Manus as well, and lots of Iranian people, Sudanese people, people from Sudan, Somalia, Iran, all of my refugees family who already have been rejected by American government for any reason, and there is no more option for them.
And I'm sorry, Ellie, we just lost your audio there. So we'll move on from Ellie Shakiba then. A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about Australia's continued detention of nearly 1,000 asylum seekers on two remote Pacific islands. So we just heard from two refugees who have spent years living in Australia's detention centers on Nauru and Manus. To broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in two other people who have been following this issue closely. With us from Melbourne, Australia, is Leslie Ann Hawthorne. She's a professor at the University of Melbourne, where she researches migration issues. Leslie Ann, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jason.
And joining us from Paris is Anna Neistat. She's Senior Director for Research at Amnesty International. Anna, welcome.
Hello.
Well, Leslie Ann, let me start with you. Talk to us just a little bit about how this detention policy is perceived in Australia, what the rationale is behind it.
Well, the rationale, I think, was introduced by our Conservative government, which was elected into power in 2013, where there were three key points made by the incoming Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, one of which was stop the boats. And the context there was Australia at that time was accepting close to 250,000 permanent migrants and refugees every year, and had an enormous volume of also temporary migrants from extremely diverse source countries. But there had been a very rapid growth in the previous 6 years of direct boat arrivals. Just to quantify that, in 2006, there were six boats which arrived bringing 60 people. But by 2013, just prior to that federal election, there had been 300 boats with 21,000 people. And there were four big concerns.
So there was almost one migrant boat a day coming to Australia then at that point in 2013. And that was sort of the impetus for this policy.
Correct. So the main government concerns, and these were shared by a large volume of the population, first of all, was the scale of growth and the speed of growth in terms of direct boat arrivals. Secondly, was the issue of security. And the whole discussion about security post-September 11 had permanently changed. Third, according to the tabloids and also some government speakers, there was a lot of concern about queue jumping. And of course, we could debate that because many people were coming from a country where there was no orderly scope for departure. And fourth, there was a lack of capacity for screening if people arrived at that time directly. It's worth noting that up to that point in time, before the government changed, you had an excellent chance of getting refugee status and staying permanently in Australia if you arrived by boat.
Oh, so well, let me just stop you there, Leslie Ann, because I do want to move this to Anna Neistat then. Anna,
sure.
You traveled to Nauru a few years ago to investigate conditions there, but maybe if I could just back you up, talk to us about why the Australian government decided to establish these centers on Nauru, like on a different country thousands of miles from its shore.
Well, as Lizanne was starting to say, I mean, for Australia, it was basically a way to put it bluntly, escape the need to fulfill its international responsibilities. The moment their people stepped on Australian soil, they would have had access to all of the Australia's procedures. And ultimately, as Leslie Ann was saying, it was previously quite easy for people to get asylum in Australia. So I think, you know, the main rationale, as you just heard, there were several aspects there, but it clearly served two purposes. First of all, to make sure that these people are far away and away from sight, and that they don't have access to Australia's immigration procedures. But second of all, and that I think was the most important one, is to serve as a deterrent to anybody else who tries to reach Australia by boat. And that was very, very clear. It was even clear when, you know, following my trip to Nauru, I met with Australian officials. They're not trying to hide it. That, you know, the reason that these conditions, as you heard from Abdulaziz and Ali, are look like hell is not accidental. It's because they were made to be hell so that other people are not tempted to try to come to Australia by boat.
And Leslie Ann Hawthorne, it sounds like to a great extent this actually worked, like by actually creating these offshore detention centers that, as our guest talked about, looked like hell, it worked as a deterrent.
Absolutely. And also that's been aligned to other measures like the tow back of boats to their point of embarkation. So between those two measures and a number of others, the boats have virtually stopped. There's been a lot of attempts, but very few have succeeded in coming to Australia. And I'll just point to a great irony here. In fact, the bulk of asylum seekers do not come to Australia by boat. Last year, close to 28,000 arrived by plane, but all the focus is on the group that are called the irregular maritime arrivals. They're the ones by boat.
But Leslie, and this seems so, I mean, in a way, it seems so capricious that people whose circumstances may otherwise be the same, if you arrive in Australia by plane on a tourist visa and say, oh, I would like to declare asylum here, you're treated one way. If you arrive by boat, you're sent off to Manus or to Nauru in the middle of the Pacific and held there seemingly indefinitely.
Well, people come from different places typically if they come by plane. So last year, the top sources for the plane arrivals who claimed asylum were interestingly Malaysia, China, India, Vietnam and Pakistan. So the people coming by boat seeking asylum have been from very different countries.
Well, Anna Neistat, go ahead, please. I'm sorry, you wanted to jump in on that, Anna.
No, I wasn't sorry, but you know, I think basically that's, you know, briefly that's what it is about. It is, you know, I think it's very important to understand that the majority of refugees who did end up on Nauru and Manus have already have had a very valid claim for asylum, and this is not me saying, this is UNHCR, High Commissioner for Refugees Office, who recognized the majority of people on Nauru and Manus as refugees, and that's partially what allows them now to be resettled. So there is no question, and it's not surprising, they're coming from countries like Sudan, like Iran, like Iraq, Pakistan. You know, all of the people I spoke to had a tragic story to tell. I mean, they were not coming to Australia seeking better life or economic opportunities. They were two refugees, and so that's, but you know, that didn't change their fate in any way, right? Because they did not even have a chance to claim their asylum on the Australian soil.
Well, Anna, if I could ask you as well, you actually traveled to Nauru a couple of years ago. It sounds like it was really difficult for you to get access just to get there, for one thing. And we heard Ali Shakiba talking about some of the difficulties of just getting information out about people's living conditions there.
Oh, exactly. And I think, as Ellie said, you know, part of the idea behind the system, or part of what it made it work, was the absolute secrecy that surrounded Nauru. Until just a few years ago, very few people outside of Australia have heard about it. And quite honestly, even I, working, you know, in the largest international human rights organization, had very basic idea about what's going on there. And that's by design. You know, journalists cannot travel. Nauru and Australia deny them visas. The visa fee is $8,000, and most likely you're not, well, 99.9% you're not going to get it. And, you know, we as Amnesty, of course, try to go officially, but ultimately I was able to travel there for a strange reason that I happen to have a Russian passport. And so I was able to basically come to Nauru as a tourist and then conduct an investigation. And the other part of it, which is critically important, is that Australia did not only prevent people from coming to Nauru together with Nauruan authorities, but also prevented anybody who works on Nauru, doctors, social workers, to talk about it. And by preventing, I don't mean warnings or pleas, I mean criminal sentences that people used to face, up to 2 years in jail for just speaking about the situation in Nauru. That law has recently changed, but at the time when I was there, the most terrified people I speak with were not even the refugees. At least they spoke to me openly. They were in a horrible situation. But the people who had to take most precautions were actually the social workers who wanted to speak about the conditions but were terrified about what may happen to them.
Well, Leslie Ann Hawthorne, talk to us about how this issue is playing out in the campaign. You mentioned that this has been effective at stopping the boats. It's clearly also a moral and ethical quagmire as well. How is the Australian public talking about it now?
Okay, if you look at tabloid journalism, there is enormous support for the current policy. And overall, I think there is a great desire amongst Australians who have an enormous acceptance of the scale of immigration which we have, to have a sense that it's a managed process. So a lot of people who are actually very pro-migration and pro-refugee want it to be a managed process, filtered by the UNHCR and with people filtered prior to arrival. That said, there's enormous debate about this. There's a lot of demonstrations, and it will be a contested issue in the forthcoming election. So people have enormous concerns about Nauru, and there's recently been, in relation to both Nauru and Manus, a parliamentary decision taken that if two doctors both authorise that a person needs to be evacuated from those detention centres for medical treatment, unless there are certain criminal issues related to them or security issues, they will be able to come to Australia for medical treatment. The government has said that's problematic, that it might start up the whole people smuggling scale again. And they're also concerned on security issues, but this is hotly debated in Parliament. It's hotly debated on the streets. And it certainly is an issue of national contention.
Well, Anna, nice to, if I could give the last word to you then. Are you optimistic that these detention centers will be closed in the next few years, or how do you see this changing?
I'm getting increasingly optimistic. I think compared to when I left Nauru a few years ago in absolute despair, and especially after a trip to Australia where the Australian politicians would not move an inch on this, I think a lot has changed. As you have already heard, people are coming to the United States under the US deal, which was also not a given at the time that it would go through under Trump. Children have been taken off Nauru. This medical bill, so to say, that was just adopted, again, as the government wishes, is a very important step because people will be able to get medical evacuations. But also an important factor is that, and that's, you know, something that we work very hard on, is that it's getting increasingly hard for Australia to find companies, private companies, who would support their operations on Nauru and Manus, and on Nauru specifically. So in one line, I think it's very clear to everybody that this offshore detention policy is failing. And no matter, you know, how much it helped to prevent the boats from coming, ultimately it's failing as a solution to a refugee problem. And it's a very important notion message in Australia, but I think it's also a very important message internationally, because there have been countries who started looking at Australia's experience as a positive one.
Anna, I'm sorry, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Abdulaziz Mohammed, Ellie Shakiba, Leslie Ann Hawthorne, and Anna Neistat. Our assistant producers this week are Molly Jackson, Kyle Lahusik, and Francesca Stottlemyre, with supervising producer Rosie Belson. Megan Smaltz is visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.